Good evening and welcome. I'm Kelly Richards, CEO of the All Access Group and the host of All Access Radio. I've spent over two decades as a catalyst and trailblazer in the digital music and entertainment arena. As a super connector, I create powerful alliances at the nexus of technology and entertainment, bringing together leading innovators, entrepreneurs, and forward-thinking creative talent. And as a trusted advisor, I work with high achievers as a strategist and coach, ensuring they have the insights, expertise, support, and connections they need to create greater impact and more meaning in their work and in their lives. Tonight's guest on the show is Jamie DeWolf. Jamie is a nationally recognized slam poet, spoken word comedian, a writer, editor, producer, photographer, and filmmaker. As a member of the performance trio, The Suicide Kings, Jamie has toured the country with a diverse array of acts, including Sage Francis, B. Dolan and the Dwarves, and others. He's a National Poetry Slam Champion, the Oakland Berkeley Grand Slam Champion here in California, a Youth Speaks Mentor, a featured performer on HBO's Deaf Poetry Jam, and the creator of Tourette's Without Regrets, which has become the longest-running freestyle battle and largest slam on the West Coast, and has been awarded the Best of the Bay by the San Francisco Guardian multiple times. Jamie has performed and led writing workshops at over 130 universities, high schools, and juvenile detention centers across the globe, and his work has been featured on 60 Minutes, UPN, and NPR. Welcome to the show, Jamie.
Hey, how's it going?
So glad to have you. We've been trying to make this happen for a while.
Yeah, thanks.
You know, I like to start a little bit with some chronology for background.
Sure.
I know you first started performing in your hometowns of Benicia and Vallejo here in the San Francisco Bay Area, gosh, about 15 or more years ago now. I'm curious to learn what attracted you to slam poetry and what your initial experiences were like.
Well, a lot of what attracted me was the fact that there was so much freedom in terms of what kind of performance you could do. I think that before I had been doing a lot of theater and film, and what I think was felt limiting about theater was a sense that very often you were, you know, performing somebody else's script, and that typically even playwrights, you know, very often did not perform in their own shows, and finding a school or a local theater to put on an original production just wasn't as, you know, common out there especially. And I was really interested in trying to, like, find something where I could do performances completely on my own. And slam, I realized, really was an open forum for stuff that could be both comedic and also really brutal and confessional, or really dirty or incredibly angry, political, anthemic. And the diversity of voices that I saw there was pretty profound. And also, there are some of the only shows that initially wouldn't kick me out. because I felt that there was kind of this interesting collide of worlds, collision of worlds that, you know, in typical other, like, rap shows had a very different angle than a comedy show, which you couldn't really do anything dramatic at any sort of a comedic show. And slams has had such a wide spectrum as to what was allowed and what was encouraged. And so I just immediately gravitated to it. And those types of performers, knowing that they could switch the same styles in the same night. And the Bay Area slam scene was really new and kind of exploding at that perfectly kind of place time that I got involved in it, which the first one I saw was in 98 and started slamming that year, and then got on the 99 Oakland slam team. And that was the year that nearly every Bay Area slam team won almost the entire show, which had, they were all new poets, came out of nowhere and ended up, you know, winning all of these slams and then ending up on the final stage in Chicago. And when everybody came back, there was just like a huge wave of enthusiasm to, you know, follow the momentum of this kind of new form of expression.
Sure, and it was a new form at the time, and I realized that from there you branched out to create your own slam, Tourette's Without Regrets, which you still host every Thursday at the
right.
Opera House. So
yeah, we just did it.
Jamie, why did you want to create your own show? And tell us about what makes it unique.
I wanted to make something that was a celebration of all the kind of renegade forms of art that too often are kind of shoved into different margins. And really to basically put together a showcase of everything that I love, which just happens to be a whole kind of crazy cross-section of stuff. So, I mean, my typical Tourette show is slam poets, circus performers, burlesque, fire acts, a freestyle rap battle, a dirty haiku bouts, meat tossing, really crazy, extreme sort of shock theatrics, freak show performers, aerial performers. And over time, it's really kind of, you know, enveloped everything that I'm really kind of into and excited by. Because I think a lot of artists, they sort of, when they put on shows, they very often just put on a show of the kind of art that they're doing. And I just have sort of kind of a feverish, like, fanboy excitement for all different kinds of crazy underground art.
Yeah.
And for me, it was sort of a no-brainer to sort of to smash them all together.
I kind of see you like a conductor or a circus ringleader. You know, you're kind of pulling it all together, a curator even, you know?
Right, right. I think that was something that grew over time, and I ended up, you know, it took me a while to even realize that that's what I was doing. and that's, I think, has made it a little easier now that I've understood that. I think when I started it, really nobody in my area was doing that. There were no variety shows. I had no models whatsoever. And so over time, I realized that in a way what I was doing was a return to kind of vaudevillian roots where you would smash together all these different kinds of high art and low art and sort of guttural humor and high fault and lyricism and sort of battles and different showcase performers. And, you know, over time that there have only been a few other shows that I would say are even kind of close to Tourette's, and they definitely have a circus environment. Because circus really celebrates all these different bizarre oddities and different kinds of skill sets. But
yeah,
they very rarely use other kinds of, like, underground kind of cultural forces like slam or freestyle battles. And to me, I think that that's what always set it apart is I've been to many freestyle battles, many slams, many circuses, and none of them would ever think of, you know, right after the aerial act that let's have two guys smash the hell out of each other with, like, you know, crazy obscene language, like in a lyrical fight. It's because a lot of people, I think, when they start a certain art form, they just kind of become a purist about it, and that becomes their whole world. And I think that I've always just been attracted into running through a lot of different worlds. And I think in the same way that why I love film is because you're able to incorporate all of these different art disciplines and all of these different skill sets. But I think that show-wise, that's kind of ultimately what I do. Variety shows and Tourette's has almost ruined me, though. It's really hard for me to go to regular shows without getting really bored within,
bet,
like, 15 minutes.
but, you know, you are a Renaissance kind of guy, Jamie, with all the things we talked about in the introduction, the comedian, the slam poet, the writer, the editor, producer, photographer, filmmaker. That's a lot in one person. Where do you find the energy to come up with all these things, and how do you blend those different facets of yourself? Because I know you don't silo them.
I've gotten better over it, but for a while I used to feel like a damn near schizophrenic. You know, and even through sometimes even the same day, you know, I've gone to a juvenile detention facility and you know, done some really heartbreaking, incredible, transcendent work with, like, you know, kids, and it's really, really hard-hitting and bleak and difficult. And then, you know, the same night and checking in on a film edit that's of something completely different, and then going and hosting a burlesque show that night. So I've gotten a lot better in terms of switching hats and kind of taking on the different personas. A lot of it is that, in a way, all comes from the same root. It's all expression. It's all, you know, different kind of forms of storytelling and performance. And I think the main thing is just, like, keeping it straight and not trying to get too overwhelmed, which can happen.
I think so,
easily.
And I think you're modeling so much to the different, especially the youth that you get in front of. Now, as we just talked about, you've performed and taught at over 100 schools and juvenile detention centers. I'm curious what led you to go that direction, and what potential you think performance art has to help young people heal themselves.
Yeah, wow. Well, I got nothing but trouble when I was in school. All the way from third grade on, I actually ended up getting expelled from one school and getting sent to the principal constantly for my writing specifically. They thought a lot of my writing was too dark or had too twisted of a sense of humor. And, you know, they sent me to school psychologist. And to me, I felt that I was just trying to approach assignments with, like, a much more clever edge to it. I was really inspired by, you know, horror writers and science fiction and action and comic books. And so I would even bring that into a lot of my essays and different stories of adding. I felt just creatively I was trying to add excitement, you know, and they did not view it that way. And then when I got to high school and I, you know, very tumultuous, kind of violent adolescence, that, you know, poetry and theater became my expression, my outlet for that. And but I didn't have many models whatsoever, and it became a huge chip on my shoulder where I became really confrontational with a lot of writing and so forth. And so when I actually ended up being invited to some of the first high schools that I ended up performing at, it felt like a bizarre, ironic, you know, twist. It felt like a joke that they would even ask me to go into a high school, considering I had gotten in so much trouble for it growing up.
But then, it was perfect. I think it was perfect.
Well, what I realized is immediately is after the first and second high school workshop that I did, that what really moved me about it is I realized that I had never had that I didn't have anybody that I could model it off of, and the way that certain kids were responding to me, I realized that I was becoming that by being sort of a wild, you know, crazy performance poet artist, that was inspiring to them. And actually I'm friends with and work with a lot of people that I was still their first writing workshop facilitator. One of the guys is now involved in Tourette's. Like, I literally was the first slam poet he ever saw, and he started coming to Tourette's, and now he's a part of the cast and crew in Tourette's. And I mean, I think it's absolutely life-changing for all of them. And I think that as long as I live, I will always try to be connecting with youth in some way, because for some of them, it becomes their escape route. It becomes their survival mechanism.
With cuts in the schools that have happened, especially high school, you know, we don't have a lot of programs. And I think we both know the fact that we did have the ability to have that when I was going through school. And I think it does help young people heal themselves by having that kind of an outlet to express themselves. What are they going to do with that energy if they don't? And they're just full of energy at that age.
Yeah, it's also there's two modes of it. I mean, one of it is the fact that they're able to just literally express these much larger versions of themselves than the world is allowing them to be, which is mostly like sit down, shut up, regurgitate a lot of this information we're giving to you. And a lot of kids, you know, people don't really think of it that way, and that, like, what we ask kids to do is we pretty much ask them to enact the same protocol, but very rarely do we actually ask them, like, what do you actually think about this? Why don't you sit down, and we're going to sit down and we're going to listen to your viewpoint on this, you know, completely uncensored. And that's what a lot of what we do when we work with kids is, like, you know, I tell them one of our rules is that you're only, well, this is You Speaks rule too, is that your only standard is yourself. You know, that, like, this is not homework. This is literally, like, we want you to write something that you want to say in the way that you want to say it.
That has to inform their self-esteem, among other things.
Well, that's the thing, is that you have kids that it's that they, you know, I mean, a lot of gifted, intelligent kids get really bored of academics. And, I mean, I myself, I'm like, I make most of my living as a writer and as a performer, and it's like, I can write essays. I just don't really have much of an interest in it. It's not an exciting thing. You know, I'd rather write a screenplay than sit down and churn out, you know, criticism of another work of art. I'd rather go and make my own art. And, you know, for kids who are in high school, some of these kids that are maybe frustrated writing and regurgitating a lot of the academia, you know, and that sort of work, is like, they may be some of the most clever and brilliant kids when it comes to, like, if you ask them to write some rhymes, if you ask them to write a play, or even comedy, you know what I mean, stuff like that. So,
yeah.
That's been an amazing, amazing experience that I wouldn't trade for anything.
I can imagine. And now let's contrast that to what you're doing with the prison system. You hosted the first ever slam poetry competition at San Quentin, and that must have been wild. Can you describe what the energy was like in that room?
That was amazing because at first, I'm not going to lie, you know, you come in there, you're a little trepidatious, and San Quentin did not exactly make you feel any more calm.
No. Nope.
I mean, the first thing they tell you when you're outside, they have like, you know, several guns, a pepper spray can the size of a football. It's the biggest thing I've ever seen hanging off his leg. And they tell you literally before you go inside, they're like, so we're required by law to tell you that we have a no hostage negotiation policy. You're like, well, what does that mean? They said, well, in the case that you're taken hostage, the state will not negotiate for your release.
Oh, great.
They're like, what does that mean? He's like, well, typically that means, what's that supposed to mean is that to a convict is that the convict knows that they can take you hostage all you want and that the state will not release them for your release. I'm like, well, okay. And they're like, the idea is so that there's no incentive for a hostage to take you.
No, I get that, but that sure doesn't inspire confidence to want to walk through the gate.
This is still not a comforting thought. So we go in, and at first they want us to perform on the literal prison yard. They're about to set up a podium and a mic, just facing all of the inmates who are, like, playing football, lifting weights, walking around and smoking. And I was like, you know, this isn't, do you guys have like a classroom and like a performance space? And they're like, oh yeah, we can do that. And I was like, thank God. So we go to the classroom space, and you know, I was a little nervous because you know, I really didn't want to bomb. I was like,
No kidding.
The last place you want to suck is at San Quentin. And so I picked this particular piece that you know, once we started performing it, the fact that we were, like, landing punchlines and they were, like, roaring and going nuts, and it felt so amazing because, you just drop all the, like, oh, these are prisoners, some of these are murderers, that kind of aspect, and realize that they're the same as everybody else. You know, I mean, they still, like, they're into jokes, and they're actually an incredible audience than most because they're really mad appreciative that you're there. You know,
oh, yeah.
And they had to earn it. They had to earn themselves this stuff with, like, you know, classes of good behavior. And a lot of them are incredible writers. You know, they're incredible. They have a much more hard-edged wisdom and sense of humor, you know, than, like, your typical college class, per se. And some of the poems that they wrote in there were just, like, staggering. This guy, this whole amazing piece, there's two that I'll never forget. That one was about a guy, he had a whole love poem to crack cocaine. And it was all about how crack cocaine was the worst ex-girlfriend that he ever had. But then she had such a seductive grip on him that it was like, you know, that every time he would get out, that she would call him up and be like, hey, you know, I miss you, baby. And he's like, no, I got to keep you out of my life. You're nothing but trouble. You know, but then he'd go to a party and there she'd be. And before he knows it, he's like making out with his ex. And then he's, you know, in prison again. And there was another piece that was shortly before Tookie Williams' execution. And there were two inmates who my son and I were both in there for murder. One of them was definitively in the past, was a gang member. And what was incredible about the piece is they actually wrote a pro-con piece about the execution. I mean, I would have to guess that they were probably both against this, you know, him being executed. But the fact that they took one of these workshops and then wrote this total flip side, like even arguing, like personifying the state and the state's perspective on it. And it was incredible. I mean, and what happened is that I hosted the first one, and then after that, the inmates, they actually tag team hosted the next event.
Wow.
And I was just another performer in it. And I mean, it was awesome though. It was packed, you know, and I mean, you're sitting there with guys with like swastikas on their face, you know, and it's an incredibly diverse room. But I mean, it's like once the slam started, I mean, they're going nuts. Like the energy was amazing. It was incredible. I mean,
right.
I literally, if their program was better, I would do it once a month. I mean, it's like, you know, everybody's there for free. They're bringing in other poets who are all like just really excited to be there. And the fact of it is that I literally view prisoners, and I know a lot of the poets that I bring in and the folks that we go with, is like, I'm only one arrest away from any of those guys. And I don't view it as that there's any difference between me and any of the guy in there. The only difference is that I didn't get caught. The only difference is that you know, I chose another door or another thing to go down. But trust me, I've gotten away with my fair share of felonies in my life. And so
yeah.
A lot of these guys, that's what
I
it is.
I get that from when you described your earlier experiences. I would like to move on, though, because we do have a few more things
sure.
I'd love to cover in our time together.
Sure.
And one of those is how you got together, if you wouldn't mind telling the story, with the Suicide Kings and what it was like mm-hmm. to the nation with such amazing performers.
Well, I think what was so incredible about that is meeting Rupert. When I met Rupert, Rupert had moved here from the Philippines. He was basically in a gang when he was over there, and then also when he came back over here. And Tourette's was one of the first shows that he started really performing at. And he had such an incredible, just wrenching stories that were so brutal and so fearless. But he was really invested into the lyricism of his writing. And we were out in Vallejo, and, you know, we both started going to slams together. And Jeff was out of San Jose. And I think a lot of it was that we just had a different allegiance to sort of a much harsher truth, whether it was like just being much more like fearless in terms of subject matter and not trying to be pretty. There'd be a lot of pieces that were kind of very heroic and, you know, trying to be inspiring and anthemic. And we really bought it on the fact that we were writing on a lot of really ugly subjects, you know, it's like self-mutilation or friends of ours that had been murdered or crimes that we had committed. You know, like much harsher subject matter than some of the poets that we were meeting were writing about. I mean, some of them are writing like, you know, you go to a typical open mic, some people are writing about like beautiful leaves on a tree, you know, or or world peace, and we were coming from a much different direction.
And you're bringing bombs to a knife fight.
Yeah, it was much more of a gutter sensibility, and also the fact that we were really informed by a lot of kind of much more of a punk sensibility. And
yeah.
So I think that we really connected in terms of that, and that evolved into us writing and performing a lot together, which ended up, you know, resulting in a play that was all about school shootings and kind of survival through art. And the kind of irony that you have these guys with these three incredibly violent and checkered pasts who now are all doing writing workshops in high schools together and trying to work with the same youth that, you know, inevitably that we were, and that had evolved into adults who are basically, you know, just a knife's edge away from those same kids.
Exactly right.
Even worse futures. And, you know, that sense of that kind of dangerous question that I think a lot of schools always wrestle with is like, is the fact that I used to be suicidal, violent, and the kid who was potentially dangerous in high school, does that mean I should be the one that comes back into the high schools, or should I be the guy that you should absolutely not have anywhere near your kids? And I would obviously argue for the former, because I always felt that was the problem, is that I wasn't meeting people. I felt understood what I was going through. And
yeah.
When you meet people, when I have like literally like, am I able to talk to a kid and I'm able to show them like scars on my arms and be like, look, I totally get it. And I've absolutely been there. And like the difference is that I'm not going to judge you. And I'm not going to ask you, why would this possibly happen? Is I'm going to just try to, you know, I'm not going to ask you why you feel this way or how could you feel this way. It's more of like, I understand what you're going through to a degree, and there's more that I can try to, but that there's another way out of this. There's
it's
many
so,
other ways
so
out
powerful.
Of this.
It's just such great work, Jamie. It's just, and you coming from that space makes it all the more authentic and really wants to make these folks, these kids, bond with you, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, the problem, what's tough, though, is when you really try to get kids to express themselves openly is, I mean, let's be fair, some folks in the school system don't enjoy that at all, you know?
No.
And, I mean, that's where you get into the argument of, like, how much do you want folks to really express themselves? What if what they're expressing is ugly? You know, is that acceptable to some people?
Especially
it's not.
In the wake of school shootings, you got people even more concerned about what's acceptable and what's not, and how many controls should be layered in.
Exactly.
So
yeah,
tell us
then,
a bit about what it was like to work with Sage Francis behind the scenes.
Oh, Sage is hilarious. Sage is Sage is hilarious. Well, I mean, one is that he's incredibly focused. The guy is pretty nonstop. And what's really incredible about him, and I think that is, you know, is inspiring, is the fact that he's always writing. He writes. He's a guy that writes every day and is filling journals and journals and journals. And, I mean, as long as I've known him, that he's incredibly prolific. Sorry, my tongue's not working. Prolific. And just the fact that he also just doesn't take himself very seriously.
Right.
He does absolutely as an ambitious and hungry artist. But he is like, just has such a wacky, hilarious, insane sense of humor. And to me, those are the kind of folks that I love. It's like they'll drop some really incendiary, confessional, really intense and vulnerable writing. And then literally the next song, be putting on a mullet wig and just rapping like an idiot with this, you know, kind of insane persona. B. Dolan is the same way. His tour mate, who I've toured with also as well, did some incredibly hard-hitting stuff and is really fearless and ferocious when it comes to taking on subjects, but is also just the most ridiculous, hilarious human being off stage.
Well, one thing's for sure, you're sure not bored. You work with the most amazing, interesting people. That's for darn sure.
Well, I mean, that's the thing is I think that that's what a lot of Tourette's and a lot of my career shows is a certain amount of restlessness and not taking something too seriously. I mean, you know, I just performed one of the hardest and most wrenching pieces I've ever written like 4 days ago, and then like 5 days later, I'm like, you know, ripping my pants off and there's meat flying around and clowns jumping around. And to me, it's that is there isn't the difference between like honesty and comedy and savagery and darkness and humor are, to me, they're kind of all in the same realm. It's just like three different rings to the same circus, but
yeah,
they all survive on their own. You know, I mean, people just do one thing. It just seems so boring.
Well, so that's a good segue to talk about the next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is the three-man play you were commissioned to write in spite of everything. What bigger message do you think that's trying to express, Jamie?
Well, its fictional conceit was the idea that the three of us, the Suicide Kings, do a writing workshop at a high school. The day before, a student in that workshop brings a gun back, kills his class, his teacher, and then himself, and leaves a note implicating us. And the idea is that the play moved through a series of interrogations, going into different monologues and characters and flashbacks and all these scenes, of really pushing that edge of why do kids kill kids, and that journey from being that kind of kid to someone who's trying to work with kids. But in that context, you know, I mean, if we did have, because we had gotten in trouble with school sometimes, we had gotten in trouble for, you know, some of the stuff that kids have written, or when a parent would investigate us and feel that we were too incendiary to be in a rural care, but that there wasn't enough oversight, you know, things like that. And so we wanted to push that issue in terms of really going into the dark roots of it. And so we toured that a lot, and then would also do writing workshops with kids before and after wherever we were doing it. And that ultimately led to a short film called Ricochet in Reverse, which got picked up by Upworthy just last week. But it's basically recreating.
Congratulations, by the way. Yeah, that's great.
The Upworthy's great. It recreates Columbine going backwards before they fired a single shot. And just kind of that darker question of, you know, instead of being just utterly horrified at their actions, which of course is totally reprehensible and repugnant, but it's also have more of an understanding of why kids would even do this, which of course are incredibly complicated. And I'm pretty sure it's not because they like Marilyn Manson.
No.
And I'm pretty sure it's not simply because of video games. It's a far more complicated question than that. And also the question that Americans don't like to ask is, why does this continuously happen in America?
Right.
I think that there's a lot of reasons for it, and there was a lot of different perspectives that I even had for it as well, and why I even did it. And some of the uglier ones I still think are valid. You know, some of the kids do it because they want to be famous, and they think this is the only way they're going to be able to do it. They want to, like, smash their name into history in a very ugly and nasty way.
They're 15 minutes, and, you know, I was at an amazing gathering of a bunch of bright minds in Sedona, Arizona, maybe 2 months ago now. And one of the women there happened to be someone whose job it is to go in
and deal with the aftermath and support kids after one of these school shootings. And she
oh, wow.
says there's been well over 150, maybe even 180 of these since, I don't know, the last 2 years, since the one in Connecticut. So
right.
It's just astounding
right.
how many there have been. I don't think it was always like this. I think it all pretty much pivoted off of, you know, the one in Oklahoma and Columbine.
Right. Well, and the thing is, too, though, is that the horrific part of it is that literally, I mean, in a way, they're kind of all terrorist acts. They're like suicide bombers in a way.
Like yeah.
these kind of self-made psychotic campaigns. And that's what's difficult about it is that, in a way, you don't even want to give them more attention because that's what they wanted. The fact that we know who Eric and Dylan are is, in a way, what they wanted. I mean, in their videotapes, they were talking about how Steven Spielberg and Quentin Tarantino should direct the film of their massacre. You know what I mean? That they were very obsessed with that they were going to be known forever. And,
yeah,
but also some of that is this horrific adolescent mentality, this angry child mentality of not thinking of any other way to be remembered. And I think that I intrinsically understood that very early on, with all of my agony and all of my anger that I was going through as a violent young man. The difference was that I chose. Art, that I chose another way to try to be remembered.
So you chose another vehicle to express yourself, but I think you'll be the first to admit that probably what's going on there is these kids did not feel acknowledged for who they really were.
No, they felt invisible. I mean, that's what I understand more than anybody is that a lot of these folks are on the verge of psychosis anyways, but the fact is for a lot of them that you hear, if you had to group all of these school shooters together, right, and what are the commonalities? I don't think bullies is the most common trope
no.
of it. I never thought that was the case. I mean,
yeah,
in fact,
loners.
Eric and Dylan were bullies themselves. And a lot of that is the way the media feasted on their story and distorted it is so far from being what was actually the truth about Eric and Dylan because I've obviously researched this case quite a bit.
Oh,
and,
yeah.
I think a fair amount of it is that the sense of invisibility, the sense that no one is listening to you, and the sense that you don't have a...
I guess that's what I meant by lack of acknowledgement.
Yeah, that you don't have a place to say these things. And I think that that's also what matters so much when kids get in bands, when kids find their scenes in something like that. You hear that a lot. Like, there's a lot of people in bands that are like, this band saved my life. When they get into rap or they get into breakdancing or when they get into something that's larger than themselves, they have a stronger sense of community. And I think a lot of people forget that is that a lot of these kids are incredibly isolated. Like just because you have Facebook friends doesn't mean you have friends.
Right. And that's the scary part.
Yeah, I mean, I felt like I was literally drowning when I was in high school in front of everybody. And everyone was just waving at me, watching me sink. That's what it felt like. I felt like I call it the invisible boy bleeding for, in front of everybody. You just feel like you're like screaming and dying and there's no one can help you.
Sorry that you went through that. And yet you've turned lemons into lemonade, but you've been making and directing short films since you were a teenager. And,
right.
and I think you recently directed and starred in your first feature film. In 2012,
yes.
Smoked the movie,
yeah.
And so you've come a long way. Let's talk about if you can describe the particular magic that you look for and try to bring out through your films.
Well, I think the fact is that a film is larger than you. You know, I mean, when you're a performer, anytime I get on stage, I'm still going to be a little pale, pasty, ginger with the big old nose and my voice and my mannerisms and that's that. And then when you work on a film, you can bring in all these other elements and other talents to create something that's larger, that still has a cohesive aesthetic to it. And I think that that's just incredible. A lot of these films that I've been working on, I've been saying incredible, a lot of this phone call, and that's being a good mood, that I think it's just the bringing in all of these different elements, like for Ricochet to be able to work with a cello player.
Yeah,
you know, I can't play the cello. I'll never be able to play the cello.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is the guy
mm-hmm.
who's dedicated
to
his life.
But this is, again, you being
life.
A creator and a conductor and the guy that's putting it all together.
Yeah, but I think that what some people think of is, like, when they think of a director, some people, and I've certainly met other film directors who like this, like, some of it is, like, they just really want to be a boss, you know, they really want to be in control, they want to have this bullhorn, they want to argue people around, and they're kind of, like, too seduced by that idea. I mean, to me, an awesome director is just, like, the utter exhilaration and excitement to be able to, like, collaborate with such an incredibly diverse array of talent, you know.
And bringing out the best in that talent. Isn't that really the job of a director?
Yeah. I mean, it's encouraging them to just do what they're already good at or trying to push to that other different extra element, you know, the extra edge that's going to bring it out. I think that doing Smoked was pretty insane because it was just so indie, so guerrilla, running amok through Oakland with no permits and that we managed to pull it off. Also, the script I wrote for it was not easy at all. In terms of everything was in a different location. There's hundreds of characters in the film, and it's this sort of rollick in Mr. Toad's wild ride through Oakland. And, you know, it wasn't easy.
You know,
but
from everything you've shared about all the different things you've done, it just feels like that falls right into place. That's your MO. That's how you work. Which is,
yeah.
You know, which is great. It's very consistent with who you are as a performer and as all the other roles you play. And that
right.
leads me to the next piece I wanted to ask about, which is your work as a producer on NPR's storytelling show, Snap Judgment. And
yeah.
I want to ask, you know, storytelling is pivotal to everything you do. What do you think makes stories such a powerful medium, and what do you look for in selecting stories for the show?
I think it's just the truth that, you know, that everybody has a story and that we just have to have the curiosity to find that out. You know, I think when you sit next to someone on the bus is that there's something intrinsically fascinating about everybody that you meet. And I think that just digging and trying to find that out is what's just, like, stunning. You know,
but don't you think that story is what connects us one to the other and individually and culturally and cross boundaries and everything else?
Yeah, I think it's because that all of our lives are chess matches, you know, that we're walking through each one of our days with a sense of survival, with a sense of mission, and trying to find our purpose, and that
and our
we
tribe
identify,
members, right?
Yeah, that we identify so intrinsically with people against the odds or how they were able to reverse really horrific fortune, and I think that that's why shows like I think that's also even why storytelling shows itself are exploding all over. They're exploding in L.A. and New York and even out here.
But my personal favorite has always been the biography, and specifically, for example, VH1's Behind the Music. I love learning about the backstory behind all of this
right.
stuff, you know?
Right.
And I
right.
think a lot of us do. Millions of people are tuning into those kind of things, to your point.
Right. I think it's because that as we feel more connected, we part of us kind of hunger more for the actual raw, visceral quality of being in a room and having someone perform a real-life tale that has some sort of, you know, moral to impart or some sort of shock or surprise or a confession. And I think that this is so much more common, and I think that that's always been the power of stuff like stand-up and slam poetry in particular, and also, you know, of storytelling, is that you are revealing yourself for your community, even if strangers, and you have to have the bravery to get up there and do that. And that being invulnerable in front of a crowd and even hearing someone's entire tale of someone that you're just looking at and that you had no idea otherwise. You know,
frankly, that leads to maybe the most powerful and potent part of our conversation, Jamie, which you knew I was leading up to. As you may recall, I found you by somebody turning me on to this 8-minute clip on YouTube of you exposing, you know, the fact that you're the great grandson of author and Scientology founder L. Ron Hubbard. And
right.
You openly criticize the Church of Scientology, referring to it as a pyramid scheme.
And, you know, I just found that absolutely brilliant that you would take on an institution of that stature and just debunk the hell out of it from the perspective that only you could.
I felt I had to. I mean, it's kind of not even really a choice. I think that what was difficult for me was how can I do this in an artistic way that still stays true to me trying to make good art, good writing, and also doing a service to my own family that has basically just been bludgeoned into silence and bullied into silence into a way where none of them will talk about it.
Well,
and
all the way to you having to change your name, your family name.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, ironically, I'm quite grateful that that was the case. If I was born as Jamie Hubbard, that would definitely weigh on me.
It would have been limiting.
For most of my life. That would even be harder because it would just be so obvious that I was related, you know. And in other case is that I think that story had you know, I performed about it many, many years ago in a short dose, and then the cult came after me right away. And then I went out to Clearwater to sort of battle and face to face, and it was really terrifying to see just the monstrous size and scope and how fearless they were and just crushing any and all their opposition. And I kind of went back home realizing intrinsically that, you know, I had a lot more to do in life before just taking on this only this thing, because they'll basically just try to bury you in any way they can. And, you know, but the story had never really left in terms of me feeling that I had to make a statement, like, for my family. And Snap Judgment actually was the one, you know, who encouraged that. And I, you know, I was incredibly – I just had a lot of anxiety and trepidation about going on record again on it and that kind of scope. But what that reminded me and what was really encouraging is that, like, you know, look, this isn't just the story of you attacking an institution or, like, taking on some cult single-handedly. It's like, ultimately, this is the story of your family. You know, and that once they consulted with some lawyers, that also made me feel better. Of like, look, no one can sue you for telling the story of your family.
Well,
and that
more
was
to
what
the
I
point, I think it's some kind of incredible closure that only you have the right to be able to do, because it is your family, and you are the only person that can weave the threads together and bring it full circle. Of course, from your perspective, you know, there, other people are going to have another perspective.
Well, I think that it was owed to everybody in my family that suffered for it, but even more importantly, that everyone that's suffering now. I mean, because the fact is why my side of the family was so dangerous is it exposed this idol to be made up of rust. You know, I mean, that you could scratch off all of this golden paint, you know, and that he wasn't who he said he was, of course, and that there were two men named L. Ron Hubbard, and they both went to war with each other over their lives, and that, you know, I mean, he was still just a guy. You know, he had a son, and then they had a huge falling out like families do. And I felt that they're a microcosm in itself of what the cult has done to people, of absorbing them inside and kind of traumatizing them and kind of scarring L. Ron's master plan into their psychology, and then spitting them back out and then trying to destroy them, you know, for the rest of their life if you expose who they are and what
right.
they've done. And
right.
and so, I mean, I felt I owed it. And in a funny way, I was like, I think L. Ron himself would have known it was a good story.
Well, undoubtedly.
I'd love
for you to expand on this as much as you want. You take all the time you want to talk about this as you're comfortable with, Jamie. And I want to point out,
our listeners, that there is this wonderful 8-minute video of you talking about this in some detail on YouTube.
Yeah, it's called The God and the Man, if they want to find it. And
yeah.
I think a lot of it is that the more I thought about it and the more that this story came about, and then I realized that, you know, L. Ron was a storyteller, and that's ultimately what he started as, and the difference is he went from fiction into a sense of you know, trying to make a profit by controlling people and, you know, selling himself, kind of smashing his name into the world and manifesting this kind of monstrous psyche on disciples. And that was a much different path for an artist. But I think also I had such a personal connection to him because when I was a kid, he was one of my greatest inspirations as a young artist and a young writer. was a sense of in every bookstore I can find books by him. And to me, it was one of my first models when I was really young, when I was like 6 years old. I remember being like, oh, you know, L. Ron, like he was a writer. I can be a writer.
And did you see Dianetics and the Church of Scientology as one and the same?
No, that was actually completely separated. So from an early age, I knew full well that he was a science fiction writer, and I had his Mission Earth volumes on my bookshelf, and I had a fair amount of his work. And I loved science fiction when I was a kid, so to me it was an honor. I was really proud of the fact that I was related to him, and I'd always be writing, you know, different kinds of stories, fiction and fantasy and crazy kind of comic book, you know, narrative So that to me was just a model, like the same way that if you were passed down, you know, being a blacksmith or being, you know, like some kind of family trade. I just felt that it was like kind of in my genetics implicitly. But the semblance of a cult and this idea that he created this whole other empire, that was kept for me for a long time. In fact, I had to find out a lot of that on my own because that was – and also people, you know, I was born in 77 – a lot of that was ongoing and was incredibly dangerous to talk about because at that point the church is getting investigated by a ton of them are going to jail.
Right.
L. Ron was running rogue on ships all over the world. Everybody was hunting for him, and he literally ran into hiding. He was completely lost to the world. No one could find him. And so at that point, everything was tumultuous, and by the time I was born, my grandfather, L. Ron Hubbard Jr., was already at war with his father, and there was this ongoing war. So, I mean, this is nothing anybody wanted to talk about, you know, especially not my mom, you know, not my aunts and uncles, because it was ongoing, it was traumatic to their father, and so the last thing they want is some little kid.
I think they also wanted to protect you, very likely.
Yeah, that's what it was too. Is that they didn't want me to know about it because they didn't want me to start talking about it at school. They didn't want people to start asking me about it and to lead me to be vulnerable because growing up they had been hunted equally themselves. You know, they had all of the stuff I say in the piece, like them learning how to use a gun and stuff like that. I mean, all of that was dead on truth. I mean, my mom is talking about how her dad, you know, that they would be followed by all these men, you know, in different cars and maybe trying to shake them and switching from car to car and that,
right.
You know, that he would find these pictures in his mailbox of, you know, my mom as a, you know, young kid playing alone on the playground. And, you know, there was a day that she remembers that after they were like trying to shake all these people, they got home and he's like, all right, so, well, this is the way life is going to be right now. So I need you to show you how to use this gun, you know, and if people come after you, this is how it's going to go.
Wow.
So she didn't want to have any of that affect us at all.
Well,
and,
no wonder they kept it under wraps and tried to sort of sweep it under the rug so you wouldn't have to be exposed to it. And yet, ironically, here you are doing your best to honor your family and set the record straight from your perspective. And I think again, you're the only person who really has the right to do that. You and they. If they chose.
Well, I think, I think that, anybody that's been damaged by him is should absolutely speak out because that's something that they've been using.
Let me change the word to you're the best person to do it because of your legacy.
Well, they've been hiding behind just a really powerful and brutal shield of secrecy. That's what they've been able to get away with a lot of this stuff. I mean, the fact they have, like, slave labor camps and forced abortions and, you know, what they've done to their critics and you know, all of that has been the people who've been in the cult, they've gotten out, they're screaming to the world, this is what's happening, that this is not just a religion, this is a criminal organization. And they're basically only able to get away with this because they have this battalion of lawyers and private investigators and everybody to try to silence anyone who comes out and tries to expose who they were and what they've done. And I think that what's the difference is now is that the press is finally more open to publishing reports on that. They're a lot more fearless when it comes to taking them on. But there's still a lot of that hangs around. A lot of people, you know, won't touch certain stories. They won't go after him because they stole the threat through every single. Yeah, they threaten to sue the BBC, no problem. They'll threaten to sue anybody. They don't care. But the difference is that climate is changing. You know, they can't hold on to their secrets anymore, and that they're having even a harder time trying to recruit new folks because, you know, the secret is out.
And yet, I understand you have a Scientology tattoo. What's that about?
part of that was one of it was just basically that this was a part of my legacy, whether I liked it or not.
Yeah.
And to me, it's not even really a Scientology tattoo. It's more of it's showing that it's balanced with the tattoo. I have the Zodiac serial killer because I'm also a huge true crime fanatic. And part of also what got me into really trying to obsessively learn who L. Ron really was because I was trying to understand when these people turn monstrous. You know, growing up as a fervent, you know, fanatical Christian kid myself, is when I was, you know, hitting my sort of violent adolescence, I really wanted to understand what was evil because I realized I had to stop believing in moral absolutes. I don't believe in absolutes, you know, at all. I believe in shades of gray, and I believe that evil is one of them, that when you just label someone evil, that, you know, a successful soldier who's arguably just killing for a cause, you know, I mean, is a professional killer. And a lot of serial killers feel like they're killing from a cause. It's obviously a delusional and just predatory one. But these different kinds of mandates that people that, you know, what makes people monstrous and that really thin line of, you know, how many science fiction writers were contemporaries of L. Ron, and he was the only one who's like, I'm going to create my own science fiction cosmology, but I'm going to call it a religion and die a billionaire from that, because he just gave into his appetites of just being kind of a power-hungry, you know, maniacal narcissist who's just devouring on people's psyches.
Well,
and,
this is incredibly fascinating. I myself am like the great-great-niece of or great-great-great of Robert Louis Stevenson. And I've never been happier to be a descendant of someone like that by comparison.
Right, right. I mean, in some way, that, especially in my late teens and early 20s, is that I definitely had, I definitely recognized within myself a capacity for violence, a capacity for evil. And
yeah.
That I wanted to understand what that was. And at that time in my life, being on that verge and being on that edge, someone who's incredibly volatile. And I think why I got both of those tattoos at the time, which I know would be terrifying to most people, but to me it was more of a sense of a reminder of what that within us is this capacity, these hungers, that, you know, that we can all be killers or gods, and that in a way an artist is kind of the middle path. Because what I hope for is that, you know, if I die tomorrow and someone finally, you know, assembled a whole retrospective of a lot of stuff they do, they would see to me over and over trying to wrestle with these kind of darker impulses,
yeah,
artistically, but also acknowledging them. You know, Ricochet is acknowledging like the impulse to want to kill people when you're a child. You know, and suicide and that sort of kamikaze-like mentality. Something like, you know, Smoke is like wrestling with like outlaw sensibility. Like when is crime and robbery, like when does it escalate? You know, something that you think is some benevolent, ridiculous, like funny world of marijuana can actually be incredibly dangerous. You know, Safe is another fellow that wrestles with like kind of the dark edge of sadomasochism and things like that. And I've just been really comfortable for a long time walking on that edge of art, of you know, pushing that, and I still want to do more in that realm and to keep kind of pushing that edge. And I feel like someone like L. Ron, is the differences with him is that he wanted to die with this heroic myth about him, but the truth of who he actually was is far more fascinating. You know, I mean, like, that the man that, you know, he's one of the greatest con men of the last century, and that sort of duplicity, that sense of insatiable lust for, you know, manipulation, you know, also mixed with your own kind of psychotic ego and mania, all that mixed, I mean, it's like he could have just tired and just, you know, tired being a clone and just started writing more sci-fi. And ultimately, he sort of did. You know, he wrote Battlefield Earth. He wrote Mission Earth. But he couldn't give up that like, desperate need for utter control, you know, and this kind of fanaticism in Dying a Hero. And to me, it's like I've been a lot more comfortable with accepting and lampooning and putting the ugly parts of me in a spotlight,
right,
and being okay with that. And, I mean, I've certainly paid a price for that. You know, some people would much rather have a safer art, or, you know, there's a lot of artists that, a lot of their art is trying to portray themselves as much better people than they actually are. But, you know, poets who manifest themselves as revolutionaries, or, you know, people that manifest themselves as models of good behavior. And I definitely don't.
Well, I tell you what, this has been an incredibly fascinating conversation, Jamie. And hours, and I hope we will get a chance to meet sometime, because we are both in the Bay Area. But I want to thank you for carving out the time to join us tonight. And
sure.
And I want to thank our listeners, as I do every week as well, because they're who make the show great. We'll hear you all again next week on the next edition of All Access Radio. And thanks again, Jamie. Have a good night, everybody.
Thank you very much. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye.